Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/InForum. I'm George Dobbins, Vice President of Programming at the Commonwealth Club, and your moderator for the evening. Tonight's program is also part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. If you love what you see, hear, and do tonight, check out the Commonwealth Club's InForum by liking them on Facebook, facebook.com/InForumSF. Tonight, we're here to talk with TV mogul Andy Cohn and to find out more about his new book, Most Talkative, Stories from the Front Lines of Pop Culture. So let's get to it. Being a successful creative force in television these days is no mean feat. Programming an entire channel may be the ultimate challenge. Just ask Oprah. Well, our guest today is meeting that challenge in the fiercely popular genre of reality television. As Bravo's Executive Vice President of Development and Talent, he's overseen such shows as Queer Eye and Project Runway, and is currently the prime mover behind such mega hits as Top Chef and the Real Housewives franchise. And with his own show, Watch What Happens Live, five nights a week, he too has achieved celebrity status, further bolstered by the publication of his new memoir, Most Talkative, Stories from the Front Lines of Pop Culture, which has just entered the New York Times list at number 4 and the electronic book list at number 1. And if all of that isn't enough, his fame and the fact that people seem to just gravitate to Andy Cohn is further bolstered by the fact that nearly 1,000 of you have turned out tonight to see him. Please give a warm welcome to Mr. Andy Cohn.
Everybody, I'm playing the Castro Theater. Thanks, you guys.
Whoa.
Wow.
Well, here you are.
Oh my God, that kind of freaks me out. I like it, but it freaked me out a little bit.
Look at you. You know, I have to point out the irony of tonight, you being... You're here in the Castro Theater.
Yes.
You are...
Well, what is the point you could possibly be making?
Maybe not one you know. You are most talkative. Your book is called
That's
Most
right.
Talkative.
Yes, I am.
You are in a theater built in 1922 to show silent movies.
Wow.
But
okay,
here you
that's
are.
That's ironic.
We're going to talk about you, and we're going to talk about the shows you do. So let's start out a little bit about you.
Okay.
Unlike a lot of television executives, you grew up loving television.
Yes.
And you grew up watching everything. Give us an idea of what you watched when you were
I watched from like 2 inches in front of the screen, everything really. I mean, like Brady Bunch obviously was like the start. And then Donny and Marie, I love like a lavish variety show. And then all the ABC sitcoms and Charlie's Angels I loved. I loved getting into a little Jonathan and Jennifer Hart on Heart to Heart. And just a whole... And then the primetime soaps, you know, overcame me.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you grew up in St. Louis.
I did, yes.
Which you've called equivalent to Pleasantville.
It is. The suburb of St. Louis that I'm from, which is Clayton. And a few of you are familiar with it tonight. I feel that it's like Pleasantville, yes.
How so?
It's very pleasant to be at around. You know, nothing. It's like Pine Valley, actually, if I can make another All My Children analogy. It actually is, because you see people at the place. Like, oh, I went to buy Scotch tape, and I saw these three people, and something happened, but nothing happened. Does that make any sense?
Now, there are a lot of famous people from St. Louis that maybe people don't know. Mm. You have a lot of company. John Hamm
that's
is
right.
from St.
Yes.
Louis.
Yeah, that's
the
right.
The Mad Men.
Yep.
People may not know that Al Franken Yes.
Wow, I didn't know that.
He's from St. Louis originally, but not Minnesota, the way people think.
All right. Wow.
Oh, well.
Okay.
Well, Yogi Berra is from St. Louis.
Wow.
What do you all have in common?
Nothing. that we're from St. Louis.
There we go.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Well, when you were young and as you were coming into your adolescence, you obviously were talking about everything.
Yes.
When did you realize that you wanted to be in the medium you so loved?
I was just very drawn to TV, and I wanted to be in it, and I wanted to work in it, and it was very exciting to me. And I always talked, and I did. And there's a story in the book about me talking into a hairbrush for 2 days on a car trip with my family, and my aunt, one of my aunts is here, but not her, she poured a pitcher of iced tea over me at a Ruby Tuesday off the side of the road to get me to shut up. So, but I...
Did that have any impact?
No. No, not whatsoever. Yes.
Now, the irony is you talked about a lot of things, and you say this early on in your book. The one thing you didn't talk about was coming to terms with your sexuality.
Yes, that is very true. There were not, the only gay people on TV at that time were Paul Lynde and Charles Nelson Reilly. And like, so those were like and they were really funny and serving it up with Brett Summers and the whole crew.
Yep.
But like, they weren't, they weren't necessarily role models in a way, or they were the only role models, actually, really. There was no one on TV who was gay. So I didn't think that it was an option for me to ever come out of the closet. I didn't know any gay people in St. Louis, and it seemed so foreign to me, and I was very uncomfortable with it and, traumatized by it, as many of us, were in our times.
Hopefully. And of course, you went out with your friends, you did things with them, you went to things that were very uncomfortable.
Right. I always had fun when I went places.
Okay,
I mean,
you went to comedy that made fun
of
gay people.
Right, yes. Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Here's a story. Thank you. Thank you. I went to see Eddie Murphy at the Kiel Auditorium in St. Louis.
Uh-huh.
And I went, the real story that's in the book, which I will share with you as well, because I shouldn't edit it, is that I decided to do mushrooms and go to see Eddie Murphy at the Kiel Auditorium, which seemed like a good idea, but the truth is that it went horribly wrong when every other word out of Eddie Murphy's mouth, and this is serious, was the F word, and it was so upsetting to me and heightened, of course, by the hallucinogenic that I had taken in high school. And so it was terrible, and I really freaked out and had a bad trip and left. I felt like 20,000 people were laughing just at me, and it was not a good feeling, and it was really serious. And I went and I sat in a bathroom stall for like an hour of the thing and just sweated like crazy. It was terrible. It was terrible. But really, this is a serious story about, that I was in bad shape, basically.
But you also were, in addition to what you took, you were going through a lot of angst.
I was. No, I really was. And I wound up going to London and studying abroad there, and they put us in a neighborhood called Earl's Court, which is basically like being put in the middle of the Castro, essentially. And I was like, well, there's no way I'm going to stay in the closet. This is going to be my moment. And I went back to St. Louis, and the full story is in here, but is in the book. But my mom said, I told her finally, and it was very emotional thing. And she said, you have to tell me what happened, what's going on. And I said, you already know. And she said, say the words. And I said the words. And 2 minutes later, she said, I probably would have hated your wife anyway. it was quite a night.
And she was concerned about some of your earlier reading too, as a young man, wasn't she? One particular book.
Oh no, there was a third grade teacher actually who was kind of a really mean teacher that I had, who made us, probably because I talked so much and didn't shut up, made us write "Screaming causes cancer" 50 times and tape it to our desk. So at dinner that night, my mom was screaming, and I said, screaming causes cancer. And she said, where did you hear that? And I said, at school. You know, my teacher told me, and she made me write it. So Evelyn Cohen marches up to Merrimack School the next day and gives this third grade teacher the what for. And but the teacher says, you should be concerned because Andy's favorite book is The Secret Garden. And I don't think that boys should be reading The Secret Garden. And he should be reading some train book. And then she said he should be spending more time with his dad. And my mom, I mean, it was bad. It was bad.
Your dad, by the way, also wasn't easy for him to hear about.
Well, he said, my mom and I had our conversation privately. It was his tennis night. And so he came home from playing tennis, and I go, have a seat. And he said, I want to stand. And I said, I'm gay. And he sat down. And then he said, well, you're my son, and I love you, you know, unconditionally, no matter what you are, anything. Gave me a big hug, which was really amazing. And that was his first reaction. And as we're talking, he said, he starts to create scenarios of friends of mine, and some of my high school buddies are here from Go Hounds. And he was saying, like, if Jeannie walked in here right now, naked, would that excite you? And I'm like, no. And then he takes it to the net, like, well, what if you started kissing? Literally, I'm like, if my eyes were closed and I... Anyway, it was funny.
But it eventually all worked out, and I believe your mom... Not only was supportive of you, but she's been supportive of gay people in general.
She has. That's true. She, which is amazing, she said, and I didn't realize it, she did have a really hard time for 6 months. She kind of mourned this image that she had of me or that I was going to be. And in that time, she didn't think that I could get married or have a family, or she couldn't imagine either what my future would be. And but then a friend of hers said, you know, Andy is Andy, and he still is Andy, and he's the same guy that he was before. And so that kind of snapped her out of it. And then she got involved. She didn't know anything about the gay community. She helped start a hospice, an interfaith hospice in St. Louis for people with AIDS called Doorways, and has been on the board for 25 years just to get involved in the community, which is a testament to, you know, the type of person she is, and which is really, when you think about it, an amazing thing to do.
It is indeed. Well, let's talk a little more about your...
Is it me?
No.
Okay.
Let's talk a little bit more about your motivation professionally and for your career.
Okay.
When you were growing up, and I guess by the time you got into college, I believe you had not one idol, but two idols professionally. Am I correct?
When I got to college, I had two items?
Idols.
Two idols. Idols. I had two idols. I did. I had...
Or items.
Yes, and items.
Okay.
Yes. I had, I had a news writing and reporting assignment to do a feature story on someone that I really admired, and because I was a broadcast journalism major. And so the guy said, shoot for the stars, like try to get an interview with someone that you really like. So I wanted to do either Sam Donaldson or Susan Lucci, who were the two people that I looked up to the most. And so
quite a difference.
Yes, quite a little difference, both with odd hair at different times in their lives. So I wind up bagging an interview with Susan Lucci. I write her this very heartfelt letter that I can't imagine what it was, but I just poured my heart out to her, and she took me out to lunch in New York City, and that's actually how my tale opens the book. And it's really funny. I have the audio tape of what happened, because right when she walked out, and I mean, I'm standing in the lobby, and they go, I said, I'm Andrew Cohen, and I'm here to see Susan Lucci. And I mean, I felt like I was meeting the president, you know? And so they call her over the loudspeaker, and I'm like, this is how you're summoning Susan Lucci? So You know, and all of a sudden, the double doors open, and out comes diminutive, almost child-sized, full-length mink coat, red knit dress, red hoop earrings, big 80s insanity on top. And she's like, "You must be Andrew. I'm taking you out to lunch. I hope you like Mexican food, Andrew, because I'm taking you to lunch." And I hated Mexican food at the time because I was from St. Louis. I didn't know, like, really? Did we go out for Mexican? We didn't. We didn't have Mexican in St. Louis, I think, in the 80s. Little bit. Noggles.
Yep. And that was not the first time you ran into Susan Lucci, was it?
It wasn't the last time I ran into Susan Lucci. I then had some insane interactions with her later in life where I would see her. I saw her like 2 years later. I was then a assistant producer at CBS News, and she remembered me, and it was this amazing moment. She said, "I always knew I would see you again," and blah, 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 and very sweet. And then the next few times I saw her, it was kind of, I wound up weirdly, I prank called her in this hotel. We were staying in the same hotel. It's kind of a long story, but it's funny. And it's bad. I didn't mean to. It's too long.
Well, you can tell.
Okay. Well, basically, I was on the phone with a friend of mine, and you have to know that I love to play pranks. At a time in my life, I enjoyed to play pranks. And there's a story in my book about something that my best friend Graciela and I did over a period of a few months where we convinced my mom that I thought that I was of Indian heritage, of Shawnee Indian heritage. And it was a very well thought out yet very odd plan, which I tell in the book. So around that time when I guess I was very, I don't know what was happening to me. I was growing in ways that I didn't understand. I was staying in this hotel, and I had run into Susan Lucci, and I was talking to my friend Lynn, who's actually here tonight, and on the phone, and I said, "Susan Lucci's in this hotel. I should call her." But I didn't have anything to say, so I said, "I'll just call to hear her voice. I'll just call to hear her answer the phone. You know, what will that be when Susan Lucci answers the phone?" So I call downstairs. I go, "Susan Lucci's room, please." And they said, "Hold on. We will tell her you're on the line, Mr. Cohen." And I'm like, "Oh no, what is happening now?" So I hang up. So I get on back on the other line because Lynn is still on the other line. And I had said to her, "I'm going to call her right now. Hold on. I'll tell you what happens." So I get back on. I'm like, "Oh my God, I'm busted. This is terrible." You know, so I hung up. So then my phone rings. "We have Susan Lucci on the phone for you." And I say, "I work called. I can't deal with this. Goodbye." So then that was kind of the whole story, really. But I kept coming up with, like, scenarios where I would be running into her and what would I say about this call.
But it all worked out eventually.
It did.
Let's talk about the Sam Donaldson side of you.
Oh, okay.
Because what people may not know, I think what many people are surprised to find out, is that seeing you on Bravo is only part of who you are because right. You spent 10 years at CBS News as a very serious news guy.
Well, I wouldn't say very serious. I did cover some very serious stories.
You may not have been serious, but the stories were.
No, exactly. I covered hurricanes, Hurricane Andrew and the Oklahoma City bombing and plane crashes and floods. And so I was sent to those places. But I also did a tremendous amount of just celebrity interviews and live segments from all over the place. One of my worst segments I ever did, by the way, because I worked at the morning show for 8 of those 10 years, was in San Francisco, and it was the first time I think I had been to San Francisco, but it was, and I didn't care, it was when it was assigned to me, I was like, "Oh my God, that's going to be a terrible segment," you know, but I didn't care because I got to go to San Francisco. So it was I can't believe we did this. It was National Learn to Bowl Week. Literally. And I was sent here to interview like a family who bowled. And it was the Higa twins, H-I-G-A. I didn't forget. These two boys and their dad. But, you know, it's a live show. So we're on from 7 to 9 in New York. And so I'm here at a bowling alley somewhere, I don't know where, at 5 in the morning. Actually, I got there at like 2 to set up, and then, you know, we do the thing at 5. No one's bowling at 5 in the morning. It was so boring and bad. My mom, who's very funny, who some of you may have seen bartending on Watch What Happens Live, she sends me a text after every episode of Watch What Happens Live every night at 11:29. Too dirty. Are you drunk? You seem drunk. Get some sleep. You know, they're funny. Oh, not my demographic. That's a big one. But she loves, you know, she loves it. But I remember her emailing me after the Higa twin incident, and she was like, no one wants to see that. No one, you know, I see why people don't watch that show, because we were number 3. And I did too. I was like, but it was so fun. I had the best time at CBS News. And actually, can I read just 2 paragraphs out of this?
Yes.
Really quick. Okay. Just because there is a section. I was an intern at CBS News. I had a lot of people ask me how I started in TV. I had a lot of internships, which I think is the best way to get into any business, you know, that you want to get into. I just want to read this. I was an intern with Julie Chen, actually. Mm-hmm. The Chenbot. Can I do my Chenbot impersonation?
Yes.
Okay.
But first. Anyway. If you've seen Big Brother, maybe you think that's funny.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was like the brown nosy intern, and she was like the intern who waited in front of CBS at 5 o'clock for her boyfriend to come pick her up. Like, she was done.
But she's married to Les Moonves, the head of CBS.
As it turns out, yes. And she's a good friend of mine. But, you know, you never know what's going to happen.
Right.
How crazy. Look at the person next to you. Who knows what's going to be with them in 5 years? Okay, so I just wanted, this is something that I wrote about my time at CBS, and it will have a point. So I said, of the 2 producers I worked for in the consumer unit, I was quickly electrified by and quite possibly obsessed with Lynn Redmond, a gorgeous black woman with style and a magnetic personality. I constantly stopped by her cubicle, asking her to tell me about the celebrity profiles she'd produced at Essence TV. Lynn had met everyone from Gladys Knight to Oprah, and I couldn't get enough of her stories. One day, Lynn and I chemically bonded like atoms over a mutual love of Whitney Houston. But, as was typical, when she thought she'd given me enough of her time, she said, "Okay, kid, get back to work." I lingered in the door of her cubicle and waited a few beats. "Can we be friends?" I asked. Subtlety was not my strong suit, and I was nervous. I wanted to be her friend so badly I could taste it. "Friends?" I can still hear her incredulous, high-pitched response, as though I were asking for her pancreas. She was older and married and living in Connecticut, and here was this gay college kid knocking at her cubicle door with a promise ring in his hand. She didn't even pretend to let me down gently. "You're an intern," she said point blank. "I don't see the common ground. You're 20. I was 21. And we had Whitney Houston in common. What more did we need? I dated a guy in Paris who didn't even speak my frequent language, so how could this woman tell me we didn't have enough in common? You know what? Despite how annoying I must have been, as I repeated to her all summer long, we are going to be friends. She eventually relented in a major way and remains one of my best friends today, and she lives in the Bay Area, and she's right there. So that is just a little story I wanted to share.
There we go. When you started as an intern, were you the same personality that you are now?
Yes, I absolutely was.
And
yes.
How did that impact your career success?
You know what?
Point?
It was highs and lows. High highs and low lows, really. I said very bad, inappropriate things. And then somehow I did good, you know, so I guess the doing good overshadowed, you know, the other stuff.
Now, you interviewed many celebrities in addition to doing the hard stories. And The, one of the celebrities whose name keeps coming up over and over again with you is Oprah Winfrey.
Yes, that's true. I love her.
Did she love you?
No, you know what? She was cool with me. There's a chapter in the book about three instances that I had with Oprah. And the cool thing, and it's part of the reason that I really wanted to write this book, especially during my time at CBS and just before and after, this crazy thing has happened with me where because of that job and other stuff, I have gotten to meet a lot of people that I've really admired. And also just, sometimes, again, my mouth, you know, it hasn't worked out. And sometimes it has, but they're funny stories that I really wanted to share. Those specific ones, that was one of the reasons I wanted to write the book. But Oprah was someone that I had on the morning show, it was probably like 93 or something, and she was coming on, and she had agreed to do an interview and basically not agreed to do a second interview that I was doing for a series about talk show hosts of the day. She was like the best and the biggest and, you know, just had said no to doing this other series. But I kept the cameras rolling in the control room and told Paula Zahn, the anchor, just keep going after the interview and just keep going and it's fine. And you just keep talking to her. And so the publicist is in the green room like, what is going on? Ripping my head off. So the bottom line is she leaves. I had lied to Paula Zahn about, you know, and to Oprah, essentially. And so Oprah leaves. So I go back to my desk, and I'm like, great, we got both interviews. I knew the publicist was mad. I knew I was going to get in trouble. But I was blinded, that I had gotten these interviews, I guess. So I go back to my desk, and the phone rings. And, hey, Andrew, it's Oprah. And she's in the car leaving. And by the way, at that moment, it was a very big deal to A, get a call from a car, and B, get a call from an Oprah in a car. Okay? It's like triple. And I started freaking out, feeling like I was a guest on the Oprah Winfrey Show. I'm like, oh my God, like, Oprah's calling me. Literally. And she goes, I just left you. Like, you know, it's fine. I'm calling you about work. Like, this is serious. And I was like, oh my God, I am in trouble with Oprah. Like, she is calling me. This is not good. This is not a happy moment. She asked to speak to Paula. And Oprah Winfrey let us run the interview because it had gone so well. So she totally, which was incredible, because when I look back on that now, I absolutely could have gotten fired for that. Mm-hmm. You know, without question.
Do you think she could use your help today?
No, I don't think Oprah can use... I mean...
Her channel, Oprah's, perhaps?
You know what? I'm Bravo Andy. What do I know but Bravo?
How would you...
How would you
fix her channel?
I don't know, because I wouldn't even speculate. You know what I mean? I mean... But I did say the other day, I love the Oprah Winfrey Show, and I would definitely run that on the channel because it was, you know, they have a 25-year archive of a great show that I would still love to see. Yeah.
Thank you. One of the other, obviously, you've talked about your hard news background.
Yeah.
And you talked about covering the Oklahoma City bombing.
Right.
That was a turning point for you. Yes?
It was. I mean, funnily enough, speaking of which, I'm sitting in the audience of the Oprah Winfrey Show on another one of the three moments that we were just discussing, and I get beeped. It was the day of the beeper, which thankfully is long gone. What happened to all those beepers, by the way? I think about that all the time. Like, where are all those? Do you know how many beepers there were? That's going to be my cause. Find and remove the beepers. They're hiding them. Anyway, so I got beeped, and it was CBS in New York saying, you have to go to Oklahoma City. This terrible thing has happened. And I said, in all my wisdom, I am in the audience at Oprah right now. It doesn't sound like a big deal. Which was often my response when I didn't want to get up off my ass and get on a plane. Okay, it's not very, you know, that's why I'm not in news anymore. But I did, you know, but my friend explained to me, He said, this is a very big deal. Let me explain it to you again, because clearly you are blinded by what's... Anyway, so I went, and it was very... I had remembered it, but I kept journals for like 12 years of my life, which is part of how I got some very specific details that I had forgotten into the book. And one of them was just the specifics of Oklahoma City. And it really was... It was like, you know, when you go to something like that, it's a few days, and you're doing for the morning show, which is a daily show, and you're shooting stories and cutting them, and so you basically don't sleep for a few days, and you also just shut everything out. It was really what you do, because I was focusing on work and writing and cutting these pieces. But when I left, I remember seeing something very specific on TV that was very sad, and it just, the whole thing hit me, and I cried for, you know, the whole way back to New York, and it was around that time, actually. I think it was a few years later, like 2 years later, that I wound up leaving CBS News. Yeah. So
you also have some strong opinions, I think, of the way news is today, and of the way news is even in the aftermath of that, the way network
well,
news
Well, yeah,
is.
I mean, I just feel like the news business changed and everything changes, but it did get more entertainment-oriented, which I love entertainment, but at the time, I was booking, I was senior producer of The Early Show on CBS, and my job was to get celebrities on the show, and we were not only competing with the other two shows, which we were number three at, but we were competing against Access Hollywood and Entertainment Tonight, and Regis and Kelly and Rosie and, I mean, 1,000 other shows. And it was like, you know, it was like a cacophony of no's. And beyond that, I just burn out on it. And you being backstage at award shows sounds really fun. And then when you do it, 25 times and you're up all night doing a piece, it you burn out on it. Or I burned out on it.
Well, obviously, just to pursue one question about network news, because... These days, it seems very few people are watching network news to get their news.
Right.
They're watching cable.
Well, yeah, that's another way that everything
changed.
They're watching
MSNBC, yes. Jon Stewart.
Yes.
You. They're watching other sources.
Did anyone see me break the news of Osama bin Laden's death? I was... I am a newsman, actually.
There you are.
Watch What Happens Live is a newscast. And I'm going to submit it for the Journalism Emmys and see what happens. I think this is a good idea. That and the beepers. I have to write that down. So I was on the air on Watch What Happens Live, and I'm sitting there. The guests that night in a classic Watch What Happens Live combo are going to be Willie Geist from MSNBC, who's fantastic, and Jesus Barbie, who is Alexis Bellino on the Orange County Housewives. And so it is looming that somehow it's Sunday night. We're live, as you know. It's looming that the president is going to speak. And then the news comes in that he's going to announce that Osama bin Laden has died, or they've gotten him. So the bottom line is Willie leaves to go deal with what's going on in the universe. And I am there with Jesus Barbie. And I realize, wait a minute, I'm about to go on live TV. I'm getting, you know, a tweet a second from Housewives people who are watching the show and really into it. It was a really good episode, too. I can't remember what it was. But I was like, oh, these people don't know about Obama. Like, they're in with Vicki Gunvalson right now. So I got to make a choice. And, by the way, I am, you know, a network executive, and I also realize, okay, if I say it at the top of the show, my minute-by-minute ratings are going to go like this. I mean, obviously, I mean, what would you do if Clown tells you that? You go to... So, anyway, so I was sitting there, and I was like, oh, my God. You know, so I had to say it right at the top of the show, of course, to give everyone the opportunity, because I am a responsible broadcast journalist... to turn the channel. Anyway, so I'm asking Jesus Barbie her reaction to this news, and she was happy for America. And, you know, and so we had commentary going on. It was amazing. And so many people come up to me and say, I got the news from you.
Well,
wear it as a badge of honor if you did.
But the newsman came out.
Right.
Well, we have to get to Bravo.
Great.
When you started at Bravo, the first shows, the first hits you really had.
Yes.
I know there were a couple of challenges and
yes.
maybe at least one failure.
Several.
Yeah.
Which
Battle
I learned
of
about.
The Network Reality Stars.
Battle yes. of the Network Reality Stars. What are you yelling?
Sheer Dallas.
Sheer Dallas?
Well, don't know about that one.
Sheer Dallas? Sheer Genius?
But, Sheer Genius. Oh, yes.
Yeah. That was
Tabitha.
That was good. Tabitha.
That's where you
yeah,
found her.
That's
but
right.
But we'll
that's
talk
right, about George.
We'll talk about let's talk about the
Are you a Tabitha viewer?
I've watched that show.
You have?
Yes.
I like it.
Good. Yes.
Good.
Yes. Do you think are there any businesses that you would like to sick Tabitha on as we
yes,
speak?
Well we expanded last season to do you know, she did
yes.
like a doggy salon and a B&B yogurt shop.
Mm-hmm. Would you sick her on any financial institutions in America?
Yeah. Oh, my God. What about Tabitha takes over J.P. Morgan Chase?
Well, there you
How good would that be?
There you are.
I think she might do a good job. I might throw Jeff Lewis in there for good measure and see what happens.
Well,
right? How good would that be? How good would that be?
Yep. He could certainly redecorate the place, couldn't he?
I would love Throw Mary McDonald from Million Dollar Decorators.
There you are. Let's talk about the two shows that were the big hits when you that you actually stimulated.
Okay.
And those are Top Chef and The Real Housewives of
yes.
Orange County.
Yes.
Now, when you started, did you think those shows were going to be huge hits?
No. No, I never think a show is going to be a hit because when I do think it's going to be a hit, maybe it's not. No, there have been shows that I knew were going to be hits. But those shows, Top Chef, I remember we shot season one right here. I had
yep.
the best time. It was the week Confessions on a Dance Floor came out. And it was so fun. I was here for like for a few weeks. It was so great. And I stayed at the Hotel Vitale, which is really nice over there. And I ran by the bridge. It was great. Anyway, but also, Scott and Scott, the wedding, exactly. And so, but I remember the first night we were doing Judges Table, the first ever Judges Table, and the Top Chef kitchen that year, it was in Emeryville.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where the Top Chef kitchen was. It was this commercial kitchen that we found because our kitchen in San Francisco fell out 2 days before shooting. And we didn't have a host until like 3 days before shooting. It was bad. I was not getting a lot of sleep at that time, nor were any of us. But that first night at Judge's Table, we didn't, the food was coming out and Tom came back to Video Village. We were shooting the food and Tom came back and said, what's going on? Like, you need to bring the food out. It's going to be cold. And we, from that night on, we had them make two plates of everything they make. So one of the plates is a food porn plate for food porn. And the other plate goes to the judges. But
yeah.
So it was, you know, we were learning as we were going along, and it was, but it was so exciting. But I didn't know that that show was going to be a hit. And it's the show, I think, that when it became a hit, I was most excited about, I think.
You also had your doubts about the first Orange County Housewives show, didn't you?
We did. That show started with someone coming to us and saying that I know these women who live in my neighborhood, and he lived in Cota de Casa and in Orange County, and they were different than, not Slade, they were different from anyone we had ever seen with, you know, bigger boobs and blonder hair, and one had a grotto in her backyard and she worked in insurance. I was like, this is interesting. These are interesting people. But so we shot with them but the first we wound up shooting more. We didn't get a lot. The interviews we thought we were getting, we weren't getting, and we didn't really know what it was. And I think when it really came to be for me in my mind was season two, when it just started to really get real, for lack of a better word. Things were happening and it felt like Knots Landing to me. And I was like, this is fascinating. This is real. And these people, and then at that time we had some casting in New York and I was so excited Because we could do it in New York then. And it would be totally different, but similar enough that you loved it. I mean, that was amazing and exciting thinking about, wow, what is New York going to be now? What's going to happen there?
And it's developed into six shows now that are active, correct?
Yes, six cities, yes.
Well, let's talk about the success. Let's talk about what works, in your opinion. This is a guilty pleasure for many of us. We watch.
Yeah.
A lot of people watch these people fight and yell and scream and threaten each other.
Yeah.
What should we feel guilty about this?
No, it is. I think it's a modern day soap opera in a reality form. It's real. It's a docuseries, and it is. I always love sociology, and when it started, I remember just thinking, wow, this is like sociology of the rich or anthropology of the rich. Like, you could put it in a time capsule. I think the first review in the Times said, and it would be like, you would look at this and say, wow, this is how a certain group of rich people behaved in the year 2008 or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And there are people you connect with. There are people you don't. There are people you think you hate. Then you wind up liking because they show you a vulnerable moment or something happens to them that you relate to. There are people you laugh at, there are people you laugh with, and it's, you know, it's engaging. And I think what happens is you just start, you know, you start getting into it, and then right when then it ends, and then there's a new group that you also like and you haven't seen in 9 months who come back. It's an interesting, we kind of backed into that idea that there were, you know, as we develop different cities, that, wow, you know, you would leave a group of friends and then you would come back to them 6 or 8 or 10 months later and see what happened to them.
There is a theory.
Is that boring?
No.
Is that a tangent? All right. I can't tell what's going on here.
There is a...
Okay.
Let me ask you about a theory about why they're successful.
Okay.
There's a theory... And this relates to the game show Wheel of Fortune.
Okay, I'm familiar
with
that.
Which is a very
that.
Successful show,
yes.
Right? And there's a theory that the people watching Wheel of Fortune get the puzzle before the people actually playing the game on the show.
Uh-huh.
Do you think there's an element, in other words, do you feel smarter watching the show at
all? Oh, I think you could. I think not. I think a lot of people feel better about their own lives. I think I think that's true, and I think that's what happens when you watch. It's escapism, and I think that's what happens, you know, but also, you know, you're not, it's tough getting a glass of wine thrown at you by Tamara at Vicky's freaking barbecue. It's hard.
What?
Tamara, incidentally, I don't know if any of you are familiar with this, we are talking about OC a lot. She showed me her boobs the other... Did any of you see that? Something.
Well, there's obviously... Yeah. There's... All right. We're going to be getting to audience questions very soon, and we would... I think that's a good note
to
say that.
This is water, by the way, I'm drinking. Fully sober right now.
Yes, you are.
I'm fully sober.
We would like...
Well, Don't boo me for it. I mean...
Do they all want you to drink here like you do on the show?
Right, well...
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
We are going to be getting to their questions. We want to encourage you to write your questions. Please write your name and either tweet your questions to us or put them on a card, and we're going to be getting to them soon.
Good.
Now, let's talk...
The word
talk.
Of the day is...
We are...
The word of the day, the drinking word of the day, if you do have a flask, and I know there is someone out there with one, I guess it's housewife. It's easy. It's kind of boring, but...
Let's talk about the viewers that watch your show and the demographic. You measure the demographics. You have a sense of who the viewers are.
We do. We know Bravo is the most educated audience, the highest on cable, of the highest amount of graduates... of higher education, most educated and most affluent of any cable channel, and the most engaged.
And
does that describe you guys?
Does that...
You're also, by the way, from what I could tell, you're a very good-looking crowd, and I have noticed that already.
You're in San Francisco.
So also, like, people who watch Bravo are hot?
Yeah. I don't know where to go from that. Do you... When you sit there, I mean, we watch you, we watch the shows, and then we watch you react to them.
Yes.
We watch you in the reunion shows.
Right.
We watch you interact with these people. How often is it really uncomfortable for you?
Yes.
You smile a lot.
I do, because sometimes I'm amused by something that's happening, even though I know I shouldn't be. At the Atlanta reunion, when Nene and Sheree started going into the fix your face, fix your teeth, and I was like, I was in shock and awe, but I also was smiling a little bit, and they had to cut around me a little bit. But I just want to get to this thing, if you will indulge me, George. There's a list here that I made of questions I can't believe I asked on national television. Okay, so these were at reunions. Sonia, was your vagina rude to Kelly? Adrian, I know you are too humble to reveal your net worth, but Lisa, how much do you think Adrian is worth? Gretchen, he was dating Joe, he's been with Lori. Is there something in you that feels at all weird about getting sloppy thirds? Anyway, you get the idea. Sometimes I have to ask mean questions because you viewers tweet them in.
How?
I'm innocent.
Let's talk about the way these shows are shot, if we can.
Okay.
Because how much footage do we not see?
On the reunions?
On the reunions and the regular shows.
I broke it down. On the, Top Chef, every episode is shot over a period of 2 days or maybe 2.5 days. And that's for a quick fire and an elimination challenge. And then you just go right into the next one. Flipping Out is shot continuously for the... Jeff Lewis is amazing. And he said to me at the beginning of this, he really is. And he and I had lunch before his series launched. And he wanted to know what rating he would have to hit to be the number one show on Bravo. And I was like, Jeff, calm down. Like, stand down. I was like, you're not going to beat Chef. You're not going to beat Top Chef. Anyway, but he is amazing because he's so committed to it. And he says, roll tape the entire time. And if you've seen the show, and I know that you have, that's why that show is so good. They are shooting constantly, and it's incredible what sometimes just amazing things happen around that house with those people and Zoila and the whole thing. But the Housewives, there's actually a number in there. There's thousands of hours go down to, 20 hours.
I think I read you. One of the shows was 85 hours to every one shown. Is that correct?
Was that what it was for Beverly Hills? Yeah, I asked the producers that, yes.
So what goes on the cutting room, the digital cutting room floor, as it were? What do we not see, and how does that impact what we think we perceive
If you see, let's take Beverly Hills. If you see a scene where Camille and Adrian go to lunch, and it's a 3.5-minute scene, or it could be five, or let's say it's five. That is 5 minutes of a 90-minute or 2-hour lunch. So really, the 5 minutes that would be in there would be the stuff that, you know, the story that is happening around them that the viewer knows about, that wants to hear them talk about, basically. I mean, we could put a cavalcade of, you know, other things in there, but it might get long.
Let's talk about the influence of the cameras.
Okay.
Because I know you've said that what we see is what we get
all
the time.
Yes.
But having cameras follow you around all the time
could
certainly encourage people to exacerbate certain elements of their personality.
Yes.
Especially the wacky ones.
Right. Well, typically, though, the people that we cast, when people ask me all the time, what's Rachel Zoe like? What's Patty Stanger like? What's Tabitha like? Brad Goreski, Jeff Lewis, the whole group, Kathy Griffin. And really, those are all people with very dominant and interesting personalities. And so, you know, it really is partly in who we cast, because, and people say, oh, what's this housewife like? What's that housewife like? They are exactly as they appear, and that's the truth. And because they're very outgoing mm-hmm. and opinionated and boisterous and ebullient and everything. And so sure, I think having the camera there heightens reality, but I think that is how they, at my book party the other night, in LA at Sir,
Lisa Vanderpump's restaurant.
You know, there were two members of the Beverly Hills cast and they're in production right now and they weren't shooting at my party. And there were two people who were very much, you know, not digging on each other. And it was, you know, and it was like, we should have been shooting. I mean, so it happens whether the cameras are there or whether they're not there.
You also,
it was Jiggy.
You've had a lot of difficult moments during this show. You're getting a little offering here.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Thank you. Of Maker's Mark.
This is Maker's Mark. And I'm doing it. Thank you. That's exciting. There,
from Miss Sachet.
Thank you.
There you go.
I'll be signing books later.
Now, there have been a lot of ethical dilemmas that you've had to deal with
yes.
on these shows, too. And obviously, the one that comes to mind the most is the death of Russell Armstrong.
Yes.
Very difficult.
Yes.
When you were not... You were out of the country, I believe, when this happened. Or
no,
at least away.
I was in the country.
But you were away from work. You were on vacation?
I was supposed to be going on vacation, okay. Yes.
So you get this call, and this happened between season one and two of the Beverly Hills Housewives.
No, it happened after season two. It happened after season two had wrapped.
Had been shot but not aired.
But not aired. Season
Correct.
Two was set to air in about a month.
So you have to decide what to do.
Yes.
When you hear this, what goes through your mind?
I think just shock and 1,000 questions all at the same time. And feeling bad for, you know, Taylor and her daughter and just a huge tragedy. And it just presented so many questions. And in the book, I kind of take you inside the decision-making process and what was going on, you know, kind of at Bravo and in LA at that time. And it was certainly the worst, it was the worst crisis that I've, you know, been involved in or incident. And it was very difficult.
And you decided to go ahead. You
yes,
decided
we
to
did.
Air it. You did air the program. You took a lot of heat. Initially.
Yes, we did. Yeah.
And your belief was that airing it would be...
Well, our belief was through and through that, and this was through Bravo, this was through the Evolution, who are our producing partners, and the people involved in the show, that the show was not responsible for what had happened. And if we felt that, these entities, the show would not have aired. And so that's the plain truth. And we cut things out. We left things in. There were reasons for both, which are, you know, which I talk about. But we did go forward. And yeah.
One quick thing, and then we'll get to some audience
oh, good.
Questions. You also had to deal with the abuse of Taylor.
Right. I think.
And you found that out much after the housewives themselves knew about it.
They knew about it first. There were rumors of it kind of after season one. But we did. And I think what emerged from that series was that this was, you know, one of the things happening was that there was a woman who was trying to get out of a very difficult domestic abuse situation, and how that played out between her group of friends is obviously what we saw playing out on the show.
If you had found out sooner yourself, would that have changed anything you did with the show? Any behavior? Would you have called the authorities? Might you have stopped
Well,
production?
That's not for me. You know, I mean, it's. I think her friends were encouraging her to leave him. And so that's. I think that was what was happening on that level.
Do you go through a lot of personal angst, you know, with a lot of moments that maybe we're not aware of, that you, when you see tape, when you are aware of things?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
What impact does that have on you personally?
you know, it's just a, it's a, it's a, I'm just trying to think of a specific example because I want to, I mean, look, that was a very, I mean, that's something that just weights you down where you just have a weight around you, you know, for weeks and months after it. So something like that, which is the worst thing that, that has happened, you know, yes, very much.
Okay. This is In Forum at the Commonwealth Club, and we're talking today with television mogul Andy Cohn. Let's get to some audience questions.
We have
a number of them. We're waiting for some plead the fifths, and as we do, we can ask you one, and you can
pick
the
dirty
fifth
ones.
On any of
pick
these.
Pick dirty ones. Or crazy
well, here's
ones.
One.
Okay.
Which reality star on any channel would you send to the moon with Newt Gingrich?
Which reality star would I send to the moon with Newt Gingrich? Maybe Teresa for fun. I would watch that show. I would film it. I would have cameras in the spaceship, of course. It would be a channel. That could be a channel.
There you go.
Just watching that happen. In space, weightless Teresa and Newt Gingrich. Good question.
There you go. One more plead the fifth, and then we'll get to some others. Why did Project Runway go to Lifetime, and would it be better off with you?
It went to Lifetime because of a lawsuit that happened between us and the Weinstein Company, which is kind of long and involved, and it was not a high-five moment.
Okay.
But I loved that show, and I was an executive producer of the first five seasons, and I love it. It's great.
And people obviously still watch it. And
is it on still?
Well,
I'm just kidding. All right, San Francisco.
Which
I thought it was funny.
Which reality show on another network do you wish you'd created, and which one are you glad you didn't create?
Which do I wish I had created? Maybe The Amazing Race, which I just always love. It's a great show. If you haven't seen Around the World in 80 Plates, it's really good. It's like Amazing Race meets Top Chef. It's on Wednesday nights. It's on tonight. And it's great. It's really good. And it gets, yeah.
There's some number of questions about you and your persona on television.
Okay.
And whether what we see about you is actually you.
Yes.
And how you've changed by the fact that you not only were a behind-the-scenes executive, but now you're in front of the camera, and does that alter the way you actually have to behave?
I think I am maybe 98% me on my show. I think, pretty much. Thing that people don't know, you know, I'm just kind of producing myself when I'm. It may look like tomfoolery, but
okay, we'll accept that.
Okay.
There are some questions about the future of the genre of reality television.
Okay.
Where it's going. There are a number of shows coming out. I believe you have 11 more shows coming out.
Yes.
Between now
sure.
and the fall, including Silicon Valley.
Yes. Yes.
But you're not alone. There, of course, is Bristol Palin and the Houstons on Lifetime. And there's Come Dine With Me in Europe. What are we seeing a further explosion of reality television, or are we seeing too much of it?
No, I mean, look, there's 1,000 channels, there's 1,000, you know, there's 18 million shows, so I think reality is I think it's here to stay, and there are just so many subgroups of, you know, there's truly something for everyone on television, and I think that will continue. There are so many niches and so many places to go.
What do you watch that's not yours?
Mad Men. I watched Downton Abbey. I used to watch every episode of the Oprah Winfrey Show. I used to DVR that and watch that during lazy moments. What else? I watched a lot of comedy. I watched 30 Rock and Modern Family. And I don't have that much time because I watch a lot of Bravo shows. I'm always walking around with DVDs in my pocket because I'm screening cuts of The Housewives and 80 Plates and Bravo shows and doing kind of editorial notes on them as part of my day job.
What do you feel is the future for LGBT programming in the media?
I think the great thing is that there are, you know, I look at the gay people on Bravo, and what I love about it is that they're not on Bravo because they're gay. They're on because they're good at something. And being gay is something that they happen to be. So Jeff Lewis is, he's a house flipper and he's a great designer, and that's why he's on the show, and he happens to be gay. And I think that's a very 2012 POV about it. And so I hope that I think that for gays and lesbians, that's been the movement, and that's certainly been something that we've been a part of for years, that they're just, it's not like, oh, we have to have a gay person on X show. It's that they just happen to be.
We live in an era now where it seems there's a new definition of celebrity. It used to be people like Audrey Hepburn and John Wayne and
yes.
Cary Grant, and now
the true stars, the real stars.
Yeah, that's
yes.
right.
And, I agree.
And now it's Nene and the Gorgas and the Judices.
I know, it's crazy. It's crazy. I agree. It's wild.
What does that say about us?
Well, to take it a step further, when you look at the news business, that's what's always so amazing to me on this side of it as a Bravo executive. When the Housewives make big news, when I'm watching CNN and it said something about Nene on the crawl, seriously. And I'm like, wow, I mean, this has really changed. And I think... You know, it's part of it's just what's happened in media. There's so much. There's so many. There's so many places to get everything. And, you know, there's not just three networks anymore where a TV star was like, oh my God, you know, there's only so many shows on, and those were the people and those were the films. And now there's so much. So there's so many, you know, and yes, but they're all interesting in some way. I hope.
In 20 years, Andy, do you think that there's going to be more reality television, less? How are we going to look back on this period? And let's talk about television in general, too.
Oh my
God. What's it going to be?
George, that is a very broad and deep overview. I think there's going to be more. I think there's going to be, you know, more. And I think, I don't know how we'll look back on this time. You know, I think that... Certainly right now, I think that the Housewives started a thing with shows about groups of women, certainly. That was something that happened now. And you know, we're going through a big music competition show thing right now. I don't know if there's going to be anything besides the fact that the entire media has changed in the last 5 years. That's, you know, and the interactivity and everything. You know, you can't produce a show the same way now as you did 5 years ago. You have to think about social media. You have to think about every other thing that has nothing to do with the actual show.
For people who want to consider a career in television today,
yes.
or the media, or journalism,
yes.
since you've been in all of it, what would you tell them?
Get an internship. Get many internships. Work for free. Try to work somewhere where you love or you think you love. It's like, oh my God, I love that show. I want to go work for that production company, or I love that channel. I want to go try to work for them. See if you can do it.
Let's ask some more audience questions.
Yes.
Let's do one more, plead the fifth for you. Do you ever fear for your safety on any of the reunion shows, especially New Jersey?
No, not really. I mean... It gets heated, but no, I don't fear for my safety, no. I got pushed by a rag doll mm-hmm. by Teresa. Mm-hmm. That's what you all are thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It happened.
Is it true that when you started that the New Jersey Housewives had some very unusual questions for you before they would commission
the
show?
Oh, it's true. That's in the book. There's some fun casting stuff in the book, in the part about the Housewives. But... they did ask Amy Entrecasso Davis if anyone had ever been audited as a result. Or wiretapped, I think, too. No.
There you go. And you do negotiate their contracts, is that correct?
I'm one of the people involved in that process.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes one has to be careful using the word contract, I suppose.
Well, Oh, right. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
There are many questions here about your favorite show of all the.
Oh, my favorite show? Oh my God, it's so hard.
Are they all your children?
Yeah, they kind of are. I mean, I love Top Chef. I love The Housewives. I love Flipping Out. Rachel Zoe, Tabs. What? What? Oh, favorite housewife.
Yep.
That is the most. Thank you. You know what? I don't really have one because, A, there would be 35 women with torches at that door if I did. And, B, there's something about them all that I really like. There are very specific things about each of them that I like. Least favorite housewife? I'm going to say that. That's what I'm going to say. No one's going to tweet that.
To do you want to send any of them to the moon without Newt Gingrich?
No. No.
Okay. There are many questions also about just the future of Andy Cohn.
Oh.
And where you see yourself in 5 to 10 years. What do you want to be staying with reality shows? Do you want to be staying with the type of programming you're doing, or do you want to branch out?
I love what I'm doing. I'm pretty happy what I'm doing, you know, doing what I'm doing. And, you know, what's the most exciting, I think, right now is just that Watch What Happens Live has gone 5 nights a week, and I'm so excited about that. And thank you. I'm having so much fun. It's like, I hope you can tell how much fun we're having. And it's just one question that I've gotten so much on this book tour is, how do you become a bartender in the clubhouse? So I decided because of that, we're going to have a sweepstakes, and I want to have it going a lot for viewer bartenders. And I want to do it a lot. I want to do it a lot because I think that would be an amazing, fun thing.
There's a question about Real Housewives of San Francisco. It had to come from this audience.
Do you want there to be a Real Housewives of San Francisco? I can't.
Yeah.
I can't tell. With an all-gay cast.
There you are.
I want there to be a gay housewife in the city. I have a really good guy that would be a great.
Real
Housewives of San Francisco.
Do you think?
I think I've seen that show.
Is the country ready for that? Do you think?
Yes, of course.
Do you think?
Absolutely.
Do you think that Obama's statement about same-sex marriage is going to change the country more quickly?
Change the country? I think as a gay man, it is incredibly, it's incredibly poignant for me to hear from the commander-in-chief that he thinks that I'm equal to everybody else. So in that way, for my own peace of mind, it makes me very happy. And hopefully it will trickle down.
What?
Is that funny?
What would you like, ultimately, here's a question. What would you like your legacy to be?
Oh, my God, George, you're so deep.
You are too.
No.
Beneath all this, we know you are too.
I'm deep, but shallow. I really am.
Shallow deepness.
I really am. So the question was my legacy. I hope my legacy is that people watch my show or watch Bravo and they smile or they have a good time. That's it.
Okay.
That's the best thing I can, yeah.
Okay, that's fair.
Do I get to keep this little flower arrangement?
Absolutely.
Tonight? Take it back with me?
Absolutely. What?
Boxers or briefs?
Well, let's see.
There's a funny story in the book about a time that I was freeballing. Literally, involving Civil Shepherd.
Yes.
I will leave it at that. That's what they call a tease.
You've had some unusual people make pitches to you, yes?
Yes.
Including Civil.
Well, there's one that I will say because I feel like this crowd in the Castro Theater will get it. If you're at least my age, actually. So But there was a pitch meeting where someone said, oh, we're bringing this huge star into Bravo, like mega, mega, lock it down, get security. It's all happening at 2 o'clock on Tuesday in the small conference room. And I'm like, oh my God, J-Lo is coming to Bravo. She loves Bravo, which she does. And I was like, oh, J-Lo's ready to take that pitch. So I go, and it turned out that the big star was, did anyone here watch Hollywood Squares? And it was Madam of Waylon and Madam, the marionette, the old lady marionette. And there was a new Waylon, very sadly, had passed away. And there was a new gay guy who was Madam's keeper. And they were going to pitch a show. And I was like, and I was the only one. There were three people from Bravo there. And I was thrilled. I was like, oh, this is hilarious. Like, we're 8 episodes.
I don't know how to top that. So we're actually going to top it by what we do at Inforum. We ask our concluding question.
Oh, good.
And that is in...
I'm signing afterwards.
Yes, you are.
And that is, in 60 seconds or less...
Oh, God. Is this going to be super deep again, George?
Yes, but you could give any answer.
Okay.
How would Andy Cohen change the world?
Oh, my God. George, how would I change the world? Okay. Gay marriage. World peace. Free health care. This is my platform. Find the beepers. And let's see what else. End prohibition. Oh, wait, that's long gone. What else? Legalize marijuana? Maybe. See what happens. Friday is free day. Do whatever you want. It's yours. Friday's me day. Take a day for yourself. That's how I would change the world. Vote for me.
I think you might get elected here.
I need your vote.
A big round of applause for Mr. Andy Cohen.
Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody. I'll see you after. I think right tonight, here. I'll see you after.
Tonight's program has been underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation as part of the Good Glitz series. And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.